When Michael Kinsley left his position as editor of The New Republic in 1996 to become the founding editor of the web magazine Slate, many of his colleagues thought he was crazy. It seemed like an untested idea. Slate has since become one of the most respected online publications, offering commentary on politics and culture. The magazine is published by Microsoft. Last week, Kinsley stepped down as editor. In December, he disclosed that he has Parkinson's disease. Kinsley is also a former editor of Harper's and a former liberal commentator on CNN's Crossfire. We invited him to share some of the things he's learned about web publishing. I asked him about the biggest drawbacks he experienced putting out an online magazine.
People do not like reading on a computer screen. One of our minor embarrassments was when Bill Gates was quoted in the newspapers as saying he prefers to read magazines in print. And I think most people feel that way. And the other thing, which is related, is we have not found a way, although we've experimented with various techniques, to publish the kind of long magazine essay or reportorial piece that runs in the New Yorker or the Atlantic or the New York Times Sunday Magazine. That's the one thing you really cannot do, or at least we haven't found a way to do, on the web.
Did you try?
We've tried in various ways. When we started, we just ran these long pieces. And we decided, well, we not only decided, but we knew that very few people were reading them. Because, of course, you can tell on the web exactly how many people have read not only each issue, to the extent you have a concept called an issue, but each individual page. And people just weren't reading them. We had an interesting experiment, which we're still playing around with, where the writer, instead of accumulating all the reporting and then sitting down and writing a long piece, sort of reports in on his reporting or her reporting as they go along. So the one we did was our writer David Plotz, who's our Washington bureau chief, got very interested in the so-called Nobel Prize sperm bank, which was a thing in the 70s where someone collected sperm allegedly from Nobel Prize winners, although that didn't really happen, and to sort of create a eugenicist paradise. And the thing sort of collapsed in bankruptcy, but there were kids born from this experiment, and no one had ever followed up what had happened to them. And David sort of kept a journal of his reporting. He wrote an opening piece saying this is what he intended, invited people to get in touch with him, and there was a very useful feedback loop that was created where people would read this and know someone who knew one of these kids or one of the parents, and they would report back, and it became a sort of mystery story. You could follow his detective work trying to track down the story and expose the skeleton of the reporting of a piece like this. And the net result was, I'm sure, about the length or longer than one of these New Yorker or New York Times Magazine type pieces. But it was over the course of days and weeks, and it was in little bits, and it was much more readable on the web. And that was one model that I think is promising.
I want to take you back to 1996, when you first joined Microsoft to create Slate Magazine on the web. This was one of the early web magazines. You were probably given a lot of advice at the time. Think back to us to 1996. What kind of advice were you given then, at a time when many people didn't even know about the web and weren't reading things on the web?
Well, in 1996, the web was still controlled, or at least heavily influenced by sort of techies and techie philosophers rather than businesses and media. And it wasn't establishment yet as it has become. And that was a very wild and free period, and many people were offended when Microsoft got involved and I got involved as they regarded an establishment journalist. And there was a saying that information wants to be free, meaning that the very idea of commercializing the web was offensive and innately wrong. And I think that has turned out to be a fallacy, that the web is a medium like any other, and it can be corrupt like any other. It can also be be a wonderful medium for expression, like any other, and it can be a wonderful medium for commerce, like any other. So they were wrong about that. They were right about something I was wrong about, which is that I came in thinking that we would charge money to customers for Slate, and that was the model that would lead to profitability. And we tried charging for a year, and it didn't work, really. We had 30,000 paying subscribers, which wasn't terrible, but we had 400,000 people monthly visiting our free part, our front porch, as we called it. And now we have 3 or 4 million. We aren't making money yet, but it looks as if trying to sell advertising to many millions of people is a more logical way to break even than trying to get 1995 from a few dozen thousand.
When you started editing Slate, did techies give you any advice about how the location on the internet should affect the format in the magazine? How being a web magazine should affect the content?
Well, one of the really exciting things about the past few years was that we were not only inventing a publication, but we were helping at least to invent a medium. We had long debates and discussions about should there be paging or should there be scrolling, how you get from one article to another, how you get from a table of contents. Do you have a table of contents? What should be on your home page? And all sorts of things like that. The way I came to think about it was we were essentially having to invent paper and invent ink in order to put out our magazine. And many of these conventions in print date back centuries. And some of the conventions are already fairly well established now, 5 or 6 years later, on the internet. And as the next few years go on, the web will ultimately reach the point where people will not have to think through navigation and issues like that. But it will be much easier, but a certain amount of the excitement will be gone.
Have you found that the writing that you edit is any different on the web than the writing was in hard copy print magazines that you did? Are you looking for something different stylistically?
Yes and no. We at Slate regarded it as very important, because people are so skeptical about the internet, to have the same standards of careful editing and accuracy on the web as there was in print and is in print. We have basically two kinds of articles, if you can call them articles, features, forms of journalism on our magazine. One is basically traditional magazine articles. They tend to be a bit shorter. The other one, though, is something which can only be done on the web, which is basically the voice of email. Email is a really wonderful medium for the exchange of ideas. When it works well, it's got the spontaneity of talking and the reflectiveness of writing. So when I came to Slate, I tried to develop features which captured that excitement and integrity combination. And we have dialogues on issues. We have a feature called The Breakfast Table, where two interesting people simply talk about what's in the day's news, emailing each other back and forth. And I think very often it really does work, and it's the kind of thing that is tightly connected to the technology of the internet.
Well, one of the things that you can do on the web that you just can't do in hard copy magazines is you can count the number of people who visited the site, then you can count the number of the people who visited each individual article. This is interesting but potentially heartbreaking information to have. If you're a writer publishing in a popular online magazine, but you find out that very few people are actually visiting your article, that could be very sad indeed. And then you, Michael Kinsley, as the editor, would have to decide, well, does that mean this writer is out, this feature is out? Can you talk a little bit about how you used that empirical system to make editorial decisions?
Well, you're right, Terry. It really is the apple of knowledge that can lead to all sorts of unfortunate consequences. We actually at Slate don't use it too much. I don't think I've ever killed a feature because of the traffic measurements. But you can't help but be influenced by it. You have to keep in mind, though, that traffic figures can be very misleading. An article that is not very good can get a huge amount of traffic if we feature it in our headline space on our homepage, or if MSN, the Microsoft network, which we're a part of, features it on the network homepage. That can affect its total traffic much more than its innate merits. So for that reason, and because I think a magazine should have its own voice and not be a popularity contest, we don't pay too much attention to these traffic figures. We pay attention to the total traffic figures, and we certainly brag about them to advertisers, but the traffic to individual articles, we don't pay a lot of attention to.
Have the writers had an approach avoidance relationship with those numbers? You know, really wanting to know how many people read my piece, but scared to find out?
We don't offer them that information.
How come?
For basically the reason you suggest. If it turns out they're very popular, they may want more money. We don't want them to find that out.
Yeah.
And if they're very unpopular, they may get depressed, and a depressed writer is even worse than an undepressed writer to deal with.
My guest is Michael Kinsley. He's the founding editor of the web magazine Slate. He stepped down as editor last week. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Michael Kinsley is my guest, and he's the founding editor of Slate magazine. He started with Slate in 1996. This is an online publication, and he recently announced that he's going to be leaving as editor of Slate, although he will continue to write for the publication. Slate is owned by Microsoft. What was it like for you during the Microsoft trial? Did you cover it? And what are the difficulties of covering a trial of your owner?
We covered the Microsoft trial, I think, in a way that proved our independence. We had a novelistic typewriter covering it, and she's a lawyer who certainly understood and explained the issues, but described the characters like in a novel. And she was not terribly flattering to the Microsoft characters, the lawyers for the company and the witnesses for the company.
Did you go into Bill Gates and say, well, this is going to be pretty critical of you, but it will help our credibility to do that, so, you know.
I have never had that conversation with Bill Gates, but I think he senses it. Being owned by Microsoft in terms of editorial independence has been a perfect experience. And I've never worked for a publication where I've had less interference. In fact, there couldn't be less because there's been none. I find it, this gets my goat a little bit, this subject. People are so suspicious of Microsoft. The average publication owned by a media conglomerate, Time Warner even before it was part of AOL, or News Corp, the Murdoch empire, has far more conflicts of interest in the course of its daily and weekly publishing schedule than we do. I mean, the subject of software and the subject of Microsoft Corporation don't come up that often naturally in a magazine or website devoted to politics and culture. It comes up some, but not that often. Whereas every time a Time Warner publication reviews a movie, reviews a book, it bumps up against some of the other media properties owned by that same company. But media companies don't get this sort of suspicion. Now, in part, that's because they build up reputations over the years for editorial independence, and Microsoft was unproven. But at this point, I think it has proven its understanding that, as you say, Terry, editorial independence is a smart commercial decision if you're going to publish content, as it's sort of vulgarly called on the Internet, media, news, whatever. You have to have credibility, and credibility requires independence. And Microsoft has really been perfect about that.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Michael Kinsley, and he's the founding editor of Slate, which is an online politics and culture magazine. He announced this month that he's going to be leaving his position as editor, although he'll continue to write for Slate. In December, Kinsley announced that he had Parkinson's disease and that he had actually been diagnosed several years ago. Michael, how come you decided to come out about Parkinson's in December?
Well, I kept it a secret simply because it was easier to get through the day not thinking about it if the people you dealt with in the course of the day didn't know about it. And after 8 years, which is a longer run than I expected to have, enough people knew about it because the few people I had told other people. And the symptoms were evident enough that it was more trouble to keep it a secret than not to. And when the balance of inconvenience shifted, I decided to go public. It was a completely selfish balance of advantage to me decision.
How bad are your symptoms now?
I don't think they're very bad. This gravelly sound you hear in my voice is probably a symptom. That's really the most noticeable thing, I think. When I went public with this, most people were surprised or shocked. Some people suspected that there was something wrong, and some people knew there was something wrong. But the fact that the majority of even people I saw all the time didn't know I had it indicates to me that the symptoms are not all that serious.
What are some of the things you want to do with the time that you're freeing up by virtue of leaving your position as editor of Slate?
The one thing I really want to do, in case I can't do it later, is adventurous outdoor type stuff, which I had no interest in doing whatsoever before I got Parkinson's and before I moved out to the Pacific Northwest. But, you know, if you told me 10 years ago, gee, you might not be able to go camping and hiking for the rest of your life, I'd say, well, who cares? I haven't gone camping and hiking for the first part of my life. But then when they suddenly tell you, you might not be able to do it, you really want to do it. And I moved out to the Pacific Northwest where these kinds of outdoor activities are central to life, and I've fallen in love with it. And I hope to squeeze a bit more of that in than I otherwise would be able to with a job like editor of Slate.
Well, Michael Kinsley, I wish you the best, and I thank you very
thank
much
you,
for talking
Terry.
With us.
You too.
Michael Kinsley was the founding editor of the web magazine Slate. He stepped down from his position last week, but will continue to write for Slate.